Lauren Belfer, After the Fire is your first book in a couple of years, but when you were last here talking about your penicillin book, you said you had a story idea. Is this the one?
This is the one, Mike. My books take a long time to write. I do a lot of research. I really think about the storyline. I wish I could work more quickly. My editor wishes that also, but here we are, and I'm delighted to be back on the show today to talk about And After the Fire.
It's a book of history, which your other two books were, but in this case, you're talking really two timelines of history.
Yes, that's right. Three, in fact, because the book opens during the Second World War, right at the end of the Second World War. And then I come to New York City in the present and Buffalo in the present. And then I go back in time to a really astonishing moment in history, beginning in the 1780s, to Berlin, where I follow a most extraordinary woman I discovered in the course of my research, Sarah Itzig Levy, and her family. And she was a harpsichordist, and she ran a salon in Berlin that brought together all of the most important cultural figures of her day. Discovering her and following her life story was really a revelation to me. It was a great joy to write those passages in the novel.
Obviously, the key point is that she was a woman of wealth because her family had money. She was upper crust. She knew all the great figures of the Prussia of her day. And she was a Jew.
Well, that's right. She was the daughter of the king's banker. Her father was Daniel Itzig. He was among the very first Jews in Prussia to be granted full citizenship because of his services to the state. And this was one of the great sadnesses I discovered. You know, this group of Jewish people in Berlin really felt that they were contributing to the culture, contributing to the state around them, to the society. And little did they know that, you know, in future times, their culture would be completely destroyed because they were Jews.
Does this story in any way reflect your own cultural heritage?
Well, yes and no. Some members of my grandmother's family were killed during the Holocaust in Europe. You know, this was part of my life growing up and the lives of, you know, many Jews in America. The details of Susanna Kessler's story are not the same as the details of my family. But certainly some of the struggles and some of the emotions were similar. They resonated so deeply with me, with her, with many people in my situation. They even have a name for us. We're called the third generation after the war. And, you know, there's a lot to come to terms with even to this day.
But Susanna's family didn't tell her anything.
Well, that's common. When I talk to friends about this, I hear this over and over, and I've read so many books that say this, that people don't talk about it, they don't want to talk about it, and yet children always know. You know, they know that there was some darkness, some shadow in the family's past, and they want to know more. And you pick up hints here and there and put them together.
And the clash with the Lutheranism of his history with modern Lutheranism trying to avoid the whole issue.
Right. This cantata, the fictional cantata in the book, is plausible in every way. Sad to say, Bach did write some sacred works that lashed out against Jews and that also lashed out against Catholics and against Muslims. You know, the era in which Bach lived was not a time of religious tolerance. People had very strong opinions and thought that they were right, and other people with different opinions were wrong. Of course, we see the world differently now.
Do we, though?
Well, do we? I was just wondering myself, because, you know, around the world, so many issues come out that, you know, make this book very relevant to things that people are coping with today. And I do want to stress that this was only one aspect of the work of Johann Sebastian Bach, by no means his entire output of work. This would be in the sacred works, and of those, you know, an aspect, not the entire story. And some people have been saying to me, you know, oh, you're accusing Bach of being an anti-Semite. How could you do that? But that's not what I'm doing, because nowadays we have no knowledge at all of what Bach himself personally thought about anything. You know, almost nothing that he actually wrote survives. There's some letters where he's complaining about his salary, other letters about household supplies, things like that. We don't know what he personally thought. So what I'm talking about is the work, you know, what his musical pieces say and how we interpret them today. You know, one of my goals in exploring this issue in the book was to try to figure out how and what we do when a work of art is both exalting and transcendent and horrifying at the same time. What is the ethical road that we have to take? When something was perfectly acceptable in the era in which it was created, and that is not acceptable to us today. How do we maneuver?
Aren't we going through that with Thomas Jefferson?
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So many things, you know, the movement at university campuses of whether buildings have to be renamed. You know, it's all of a piece. How do we view the past in its stark reality with the way we approach the world now? These are very difficult questions, and I don't claim to have any answer to these questions. You know, when it comes to artwork of all kinds, many people will say, well, it doesn't matter anymore what the context of creation was for these works of art. All that matters now is the aesthetics of the art. If it's beautiful, it's fine, no problem. That's what some critics would say. I strongly disagree with that. I think that people really do need to know and discuss what the context was. That doesn't mean that we have to reject these works of art that are problematic to us today. It just means that we have to be aware of what they're really saying and weave that into our understanding of them. And I think it adds a greater depth to the works. And then we have to decide whether we are going to go on and enjoy them or enjoy them in a different way.
Isn't that the dilemma of your Protestant, of your Lutheran minister in this book, that he's forced to confront Bach in his worst side today?
Well, I think of the Lutheran minister in the book as really being at the moral center of the book. And to him, you know, the music of Bach leads him to God. And so it's very hard for him to reconcile all these different strains of thought. But at the end, and I shouldn't give too much away, I guess, but I will say that at the end he decides that the best course for him is to confront what was said, not to sweep things under the rug, but to talk about it and to, in a sense, force his parishioners to face up to the unpleasant realities of the past rather than just pretend they never happened.
I just saw a very strong production of Judgment at Nuremberg, and that's really at the heart of that play also.
Yes, I've never seen that play, but I can imagine, you know, these issues, these lines, you know, how do we survive looking back at what was done in the past? They're very difficult issues, very hard to find a solution. And as I say, I don't pretend that I have a solution, but I'm just trying to bring these ideas out to be looked at and discussed.
Is it painful to research a book like this?
It was hard, I have to say. You know, there are some scenes, there's a scene in a concentration camp today, you know, so we don't even see what actually happened there, but to relate what it's like to visit one today, it's a horrifying experience, even though the sites have been relatively sanitized, I suppose is the best word, and to follow those strains of anti-Semitism from the 18th century through the Holocaust into the present, it was very hard. But I felt that it was something I had to do. You know, it was an idea that wouldn't let me go. I had to pursue the idea wherever it took me.
What was the hardest part, that technically, as a novelist, about the book?
Well, the book goes back and forth in time, as we've said, and it was very important to me to set up a rhythm between the past and the present so that each era was illuminating the other, so that questions might be raised in the present, for example, that were then answered in the past. And then questions might come up in the past that were answered in the present. So that the past and the present are sort of bouncing off one another, or dancing together, if you will, you know, doing a very careful dance with each other, so that even though we are switching back and forth in time, it's one story told through the prism of this ethically problematic work of art. And establishing that dance and really getting it to work from chapter to chapter was a difficult technical problem for me. But I, when I look at the book now, I do sense that there is that dance that I wanted to achieve. And I just hope that readers think that that part of the book is successful, that it flows smoothly back and forth in time, and they can follow the stories easily.
After doing this book, can you listen to Bach quite the same way?
Well, you know, I love the music of Bach, and one of the joys of writing the book was discovering all the music of Bach. You know, and as I say, this issue that we're talking about, the problematic ethical issue, is only one aspect of his compositional life. The concertos, the keyboard works, I adore them. I listen to that music all the time. And many of his sacred cantatas don't have any issues of anti-Semitism in them or anything anti-Catholic in them. They're wonderful. The music is wonderful, and I would encourage everyone who's not familiar with it to listen to it. But I do listen knowing that some of the pieces have these issues embedded in them. And I take that into account when I listen. I think that it adds a complexity to my understanding of the work. It doesn't stop my appreciation for his extraordinary genius.
Lauren Belfer is the author of the new book, And After the Fire. Lauren Belfer, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much, Mike. It's a pleasure to talk to you today.